Our Bible reading tonight is in your flyer and it comes from John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants knew who had drawn the water. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then hands out the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Well, one of the occupational hazards, I think, of Christian ministry and of Christian life in general is that you end up going to a lot of weddings. I thought it was a problem just as a pastor, but it turns out just in the Christian community, there are lots of weddings. People get married and you get invited along to them, and so I'm sure we've all been to plenty of weddings. I've been to my fair number, and occasion most weddings that I go to, completely fine. Everything goes off without a hitch, and the fretting of the couple was unnecessary. But occasionally, just to terrify you if it's ahead of you, that sometimes things do go quite badly wrong. I can think of three situations in my life in recent memory. One was just where the catering, there literally was not enough food. And between the main course and the dessert, a group of people snuck off and got some Hungry Jacks in the middle of that. Another one was a lovely Australian guy who had married someone from a very lovely and kind of, dignified subcontinental community. And at the speeches, his best man systematically alienated that whole half of his new family with a series of like inappropriate Australian style jokes. And I was at a wedding once which was delayed by half an hour, not because of the bride, but because the groom had lost his trousers. And so we had to tell the crowd to wait while he was coming. I mention that because the story that I just want to look at with you for a few minutes tonight is the story of a wedding, and it's at a wedding at which something goes kind of horribly and catastrophically wrong. Jesus does something about it, and in doing what he does, he reveals his glory, and his disciples, to use an anachronism, kind of become Christians. They put their faith in him because of what he does at this wedding. So I just want to think with you for a few moments about what it was that he did and how that might shape our thinking as disciples and for the graduates as ministers. So the story is there, very familiar to many people in the room. The location is Cana, which is in the north of Israel. And the guest list at the wedding includes Jesus, the disciples and his mother. And there's a catering crisis. Things are normally anxious at weddings, even in Australia. But I want to put it out that I think a wedding in the ancient world is more anxiety-driven than a modern wedding. In the ancient world, people just spent a much higher proportion of their annual income on weddings and funerals than we do. It was just a bigger deal for them. A Jewish wedding at the time would last 3 or 4 days. And during those 3 or 4 days, you were responsible for the entire catering and hospitality needs of the people that came, that you were to look after. So the demands of a wedding were huge. And as some people in this room will be able to relate to and others will find more alien, this was a culture that had a much stronger and acute sense of honour and a much more acute sense of shame. So a culture where how you were perceived in the community whose opinions mattered to you mattered enormously. And a wedding, maybe more than anything else, it was your chance for your stocks, your honour or your shame to go up or down according to how you treated your guests. And in that context, there's a disaster. They run out of wine. They run out of wine, and the mother of Jesus, Mary, comes to Jesus and says to them, they have no more wine. And a question, how do you read those words? I think in a church service, the exegesis doesn't begin with the sermon. It begins with the Bible reading. Right? The Bible reading is the first point at which we start to interact with the passage and start to make sense of it as a Christian community. So if you're a Bible reader in public services, how would you read that sentence? Like, is Mary saying it in a gossipy voice? Like, oh, the DJ didn't show up. Oh, did you hear the dresses from Good Sammy's? They've run out of wine. Is it that sort of thing? Is it a kind of celebration? Because depending on what kind of Christian background you're from, you could perceive that the moment the wedding runs out of wine is the moment where you can really get things going on and say, come on, kids, come in. The party's really started. The wine's gone. It's safe here now and we can get on with things. So is it a kind of a celebration? Is it gossipy? I think what it is the kind of language that families, families work in kind of codes and they know more than they speak. Because I read that and I think Jesus is kind of saying no. His mother says to him, they have no more wine. He immediately understands that not as a comment or gossip, but as a kind of instruction. He says, my time has not yet come. And so I think he said no. And then she goes to the servants and says, do whatever he asks you. So in the kind of code language of families, they know what they're saying. And Jesus kicks into action. He sees some water jars. He directs the servants to fill the jars with water. They fill them to the brim. And then he tells them to take that water to the host. And remember, the host doesn't know what's going on. People aren't gathered around to witness this thing. It just turns into wine sort of off scene. The host goes, tastes the wine and goes immediately to the groom and takes him aside and says, in effect, you dirty dog. Dude. What a flex. Most people at weddings, they'll do the posh stuff first, and as people's judgment kind of deteriorates, then, you know, you move from the Grange to the Goon on the way through. And then, dude, you flip this, man. You've saved the best till last. That's the story. Now, as I'm saying, I reckon the story for lots of us would be familiar. Maybe if you're here because you're not from the Christian religion or from no religion, but you're here to support your friends and family, it might be a new and interesting story. For lots of us, it is a familiar story. But the thing I want you to notice is that it's a story, an event that has a huge impact on the disciples. John says, the writer of the gospel, John says it's the moment that Jesus revealed his glory. And it says it's the moment that the disciples trusted in him, put their faith in him, which makes me think, what did I miss? What was it about this that was so obviously glorious? What was the moment about this that the disciples just suddenly thought, snap, it's him. I'm on team Jesus. Got a few clues. Firstly, did you notice, as you kind of go back through, did you notice the quantity of the wine? Like, there is a lot of wine. John tells us 6 stone jars, each filled to the brim, each having 20 to 30 gallons of water. By my calculations, Jesus produced about 600 litres of extra wine for the guests late in the party. That's enough for 3 extra litres of wine for every guest there, which means that Jesus definitely loses his responsible service of alcohol licence. The quantity is just huge. Secondly, looking for clues, there's a quality thing. I think this is the one that stuck with me since childhood. I always remembered that Jesus seemed to have made really good wine. And I think my childhood take on that was that, of course, you would expect Jesus to be good at most things, including, you know, wine. he's going to be good at stuff, including wine. He's good at wine. But then why not just say it was good wine? There's something here. They're kind of labouring the point. Notice that the servant goes to the host and has this verse 9 and 10. He says, verse 7, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you've saved the best till now. You've saved the best till last. In literature, kind of irony is a big complicated concept, but part of the idea of irony is that speakers in a story will sometimes say more than they know. That they'll say something that is true, but it is truer than they could possibly understand. And in this story, the host, who has no idea what is going on, goes and says, you've saved the best till last. Back in John chapter 1, John the Baptist comes explaining who he is with respect to Jesus. And you remember that convoluted sentence? He says, he who came after me has surpassed me because he was before me. That the one who comes second is greater. That the one that I point to, that's for us, that's almost obvious. Because we live in a technological society, so we think that our next iPhone is going to be better than our last iPhone and that our kids will have, you know, technology and advantages that we don't have. In the ancient world, of course, it's the exact opposite. So in the ancient world, you walk past the pyramids or you walk past, the hanging gardens or, the Roman statues and you think, oh, man, we're pathetic compared to the previous generations. Like, that was the golden age. We've deteriorated enormously. And so John has to come in and say, actually, the one who comes after me has surpassed me. Well, back in John chapter 1, the law came through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. You've saved the best till last. Thirdly, notice the kind of water it is. This is the last clue. Jesus turns water into wine, but did you notice what the water was? Verse 6, nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing. That's an interesting bit of extra information, right? That we know not only that it's water, we know what kind of water it was. We know that it was the water that the Jews used for ritual cleansing, for bathing in the morning and in the evening, not for hygiene reasons, but in order to remember that across the day and across the night they had done things and said things and failed to do things and failed to say things that meant that they had achieved the status of unclean before God. Every morning, every evening, you wash yourself in that water. And it's that water that Jesus turns into the best wine anyone at the party has ever tasted. That's got to mean something, right? I like to imagine that you're at the wedding and you wake up the next morning and you've kind of had the night and you go to the thing, oh, I better go wash myself because there's no telling, you know, where I am with God now. And you go to grab the water and then just a big splash of Grange Hermitage in your face and you think, and if that happened, surely you're thinking, wow, that means something. Something significant has happened. And I think what John is saying to us is that at that point, at the wedding in Cana, where Jesus reveals his glory, where he gives us the sign, the first of the signs, and where the disciples believe in him, the sign is the sign of the abundant, over the top, too much, wild, unrestrained, unmerited forgiveness and love of God. I think that's what it is. It's the sign that reveals the glory of Jesus. Because what is the glory of Jesus? If I can put it this way, and this may not be entirely theologically accurate, but if I can say, what is the best thing about Jesus? Because there's tons of good stuff about Jesus, right? He brings order and meaning to a life. He has this extraordinary ethical teaching. He brings out prayers to the Father. He's the maker and sustainer of all things. By him, the world, all things hold together. There is so much about Jesus that is so great. But what is his glory? What's the thing that you think, above all else, when I think of Jesus and when I think of someone who doesn't know Jesus and I want them to know something about Jesus, what's the thing I want them to know? I want them to know that in Jesus, God saved the best till last. That in Jesus, he can and he did and he does pour out his abundant, overflowing, too much, too generous, lavish provision for our need to be right with God. That's the point at which the disciples, to use an anachronism, become Christians. It's the point where they go from believing that Jesus is worth a bit of investment, worth following, worth investigating. Something flips at the wedding when the ritual water turns into wine, where they put their faith in him, where they perceive his glory, where they feel the weight of the greatness of Jesus. And the best thing about Jesus is that he forgives our sins, that he makes us clean, makes us right with God. I want to speak to the graduates particularly for a moment. I've noticed this pattern. I think it's a pattern. You can tell me if you've seen it in the world. So when you get married, if you've ever got married, often in the lead up, everyone's like celebrating. It's like, woohoo, yeah, you're getting married. You have a bunch of celebrations and so on. And then you have the wedding ceremony and then people dress a bit like they're dressed tonight. And they're like, whoa, this is amazing. And you kind of dance afterwards and so on. And you get married and everyone's like, this is great, this is great, this is great. And then a year later, it's really hard. And you go back to your friends and say, were you going to tell me about this? And they're like, oh yeah, it's like that. Yeah, yeah, we just say that at the time. But where you go, or, I'll give you another example. Again, we won't all have had this experience, but when people have a kid, and at the start, this is just between us, and at the start, there's just like people dress up, and there's like, baby showers, and people are really excited, and so on. They say, this is just the best thing in the world. Your life is about to be invaded with joy and all that. And that's true, but then like 9-12 months later, you're talking to those same people and saying, dude, my eyelids feel like sandpaper. Weddings and baby showers and graduation ceremonies. Kind of dress up, and I've got a little bit of math I want to work on. That the way people dress and how much they clap is inversely proportionate to how much they're secretly signalling to you that some really hard things are going to happen. I think that's true. And again, I don't think at your wedding, if you got married, that anyone was purposely lying to you. I think they also thought it was worth it and that it's great. And they also thought that about your first kid, that it was worth it and it was great, but they just couldn't bring themselves to say, oh yeah, it's kind of really hard. And so I think with ministry, I don't want to be like that person who's saying it's insanely hard or uniquely hard or panic stations hard. I think the best I can do is to say it is harder than I could have ever believed when I was in your position. That I don't think anyone could have said to me, probably true for a wedding, probably true for babies, I don't think anyone could have explained to me in a way that I could have comprehended just how kind of wickedly difficult it is or can be. And the things that are difficult are kind of things that sometimes you haven't necessarily anticipated or prepared for, the conflicts among leadership, conflicts in the congregation, that just the relentless demands of compliance and making it all make sense, and the constant ambiguity of the like 11 people that are proper claimants on your time at this time, and you think who can sustain the most reasonable amount of disappointment as I attend to this thing and not that thing. It is harder than I could have understood. And therefore, I think that we need to remember the best thing about Jesus. The thing that we signed up for in the first place, because I bet it's that, right? I bet at some point in your journey, it wasn't that you thought, I love forms, documents, give me conflict, give me... I bet it was because at some point you did what the disciples did at the wedding in Cana and somehow made the connection and thought, yeah, Jesus, sins, my sins. He died for me. His abundant grace has been lavished on me. And I think in the best moments and in the darkest hours, they're the things, that's the thing that is the glory of Jesus that makes the rest of it totally and utterly worth it. So God bless you and go in the power of the Lord.